Dr. Catherine Albrecht is our guest today, and the topic is surveillance technology and the threats posed by it. Dr. Albrecht is the best-selling author of Spy Chips. She works on the team of the private search engine and email service StartPage and StartMail, and has her own syndicated radio show on GCN, which you can listen to on CatherineAlbrecht.com. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Albrecht.
Hi. Well, it's really great to be with you.
Good to have you here with us. Let's start out with the first question. Your book on RFID chips came out almost a decade ago, and in terms of surveillance technology, so much has been changing. Your warnings still ring true, but it seems we can add dozens of surveillance threats on top of the RFID chips, which you warned about. What are some of the strongest threats in your mind since spy chips came out at the moment? For example, you know, is it still RFID? Now we've got issues with drones, Windows 10, which you've been talking about, these ubiquitous cell phone networks. What's on your mind at the moment?
I think really all of that, you really did a great job of summing it up. So 10 years ago when, and actually it was more like 12 or 13 years ago, I was actually sitting in a meeting that I had crashed of some of the biggest corporations on the globe, and they were talking about plans to secretly put tracking devices into every object manufactured on Earth using RFID, which we call spy chips. And they had done some research and found that the majority, like 89% of people, were opposed to this because they didn't trust the corporations and the government not to abuse the ability to track people and identify their belongings inside their backpacks or figure out what color underwear they're wearing as they walk through a doorway. It was just creepy. And so their plan was to introduce the technology secretly and just hope no one would find out. And there are ways that you can put these devices, as we describe in the book Spy Chips. You can put them into the soles of shoes. You can drop them into the mold when the plastic is still liquid and the sole of the shoe forms around the tag. So there'd be no way to know it. And so, as you know, we went into a lengthy, probably 5-year opposition process with pickets outside of stores, legislation, testimony before the Federal Trade Commission, our best-selling book, Spy Chips. We really went, pretty much it was my full-time job, and we had 18,000 people on our team working with us to do this. And we were able to stop the RFID threat, which is very interesting because I've heard from people in the industry that we cost them $100 million by just basically alerting the public to this technology that people already didn't like. We didn't have to do much convincing that it was bad. I think people already knew that. But the very fact that there was an opposition movement against it forced these companies to drop plans to use it. So Gillette, we have boycottgillette.com, boycotttesco.com, which is the biggest grocery chain in England. We protested against basically any company that was using this technology. We protested outside of Walmart stores, and we got them to stop. What's interesting, though, is as I go back and I reread Spy Chips, a lot of what, I would say most of what we wrote about was before its time, because we used the industry's own plans and we exposed those plans. And now, 10 years later, they're coming back and trying to dust those plans off and do it again. And I think they figure that because of ubiquitous cell phones and drones and the other things that you're talking about, that people maybe won't care so much if they begin tracking their physical belongings. And so just within the last couple of months, we've discovered that Target stores, which is a huge, huge retailer here in the U.S., and I believe they're all across the globe, that Target stores have begun secretly putting RFID tags into their products already, and they're going to do a formal official rollout next year in 2016. So it looks like they're gearing up to do this again. And the biggest concern that I have, just for RFID, if I could discuss that before we move on to some of the other threats, is that the U.S. government, as you know, the Real ID Act, which gives federal control over state-issued driver's licenses, is going into full effect as some of those provisions are implemented. And I happen to live in the Live Free or Die state of New Hampshire. We actually have Live Free or Die on our license plates in this state. And we're one of the states that passed a law several years ago saying that we would not participate in the Real ID Act with the U.S. government, which means that as of next year, residents of the state of New Hampshire will be prohibited from getting on airplanes unless our government the government of our state complies with this federal mandate. So it's been really interesting that over the last couple of years, all the opposition to Real ID, which was so strong and fervent, has really kind of settled down. And now there are calls for New Hampshire to become compliant with this so that we can get on airplanes. And, you know, it's really an example of the big brother federal government strong arming us and forcing governments whose democratically elected leaders have passed laws saying that they don't want to participate, really forcing them to participate anyway, whether they want to or not. And speaking of driver's licenses, one of the biggest concerns that I have is something called an enhanced driver's license. And this, if we're not careful, is going to be rolled out in other countries as well. It's an optional program where instead of getting a regular driver's license, you can go into your DMV in a number of border states, bordering on Canada and Mexico, and you can pay an extra fee and provide additional identification, and you can receive something called an enhanced driver's license. And this is really a misnomer. It should actually be called a total spy driver's license because it's a tracking device. And when you get one of these enhanced driver's licenses, the border patrol people have boasted that you can save 15 seconds off of your border crossing, as though that were a big advantage, because when you put the driver's license on your dashboard of your car, then it enables the border crossing guard to identify you and pull up all of your records on the screen when you're still 50 feet away from the actual kiosk. So in other words, they have remote readers that are capable of detecting the information in your driver's license, pulling up your information on the screen. And obviously, if they're able to do that, anyone would be able to do that. That anyone who wants to put an RFID reader at any location, secretly hidden in a wall or a doorway or a lamppost, would be able to pull up the same type of information, or at least pull up your unique ID number and identify potentially who you are. And the big concern that I have about these enhanced driver's licenses is I think they're part of a larger plan, because in 2005, when there was debate over these driver's licenses, everyone objected to the protocol or the type of technology that they wanted to put in the enhanced driver's licenses, the form of RFID. And it is possible for the U.S. government to put a form of ID like they've done in the passports. That's the open blue books that have the flip through the pages with a cover on them. They actually put a form of RFID in the passports that we objected to as well, but it's not as bad. The RFID in the passport is a special proprietary protocol, which means it speaks a language that only the U.S. government has the ability to decode. What's more, they're encrypted, which means if you don't have the encryption key, you can't read them anyway. And they only have a read range of a couple of inches, so you wouldn't be able to read one from 50 feet away or across a block or through a hotel room, you know, wall from the next hotel room over, as you can with the enhanced driver's licenses. And they put shielding material in the cover of the passport. So when it's closed, presumably, if it's closed all the way, it won't be able to actually transmit because it's got a blocking fabric woven into the cover. Mm-hmm. Now, onto the enhanced driver's licenses. They have already been issued to hundreds of thousands of Americans, and I believe that there will come a time when they become mandatory for all Americans and all driver's licenses. And I think this is one of the reasons why the Real ID Act was such a big deal to the federal government, is I believe they want to have control over what used to be 50 individual states issued identity documents through driver's licenses. When the federal government took control of that by passing the Real ID Act, they basically, I think, were planning for a future where they're going to mandate certain technologies to be in those licenses, similar to the enhanced driver's licenses being optionally used by these people in border states today. So here's the kicker, though. Instead of putting a proprietary encrypted secure microchip into the enhanced driver's licenses, what the State Department chose to do is to put the same exact form of RFID in the driver's licenses that is being used in Fruit of the Loom underwear in Walmart stores and every other product in Target and everywhere where RFID is being used for inventory management and managing, like a barcode, managing products. So by choosing that insecure form of RFID, here's what they've done. They've actually guaranteed that every Walmart reader, whether it's in a doorway, whether it's in an underwear display, or whether it's in the hands of a minimum wage Walmart retail worker, is capable of reading your enhanced driver's license. And so what this means is that they've created, basically the federal government is relying on the idea that retail and industry will create the reader devices and blanket the world with them, that they will be in every doorway, in every refrigerator, in every home, that they will be in every garage, every car, that they will be in every display, that they will be in museums, restaurants, theaters, libraries, public restrooms, elevators, every place that people go. It is anticipated that within a few short years, there will be RFID readers embedded in those environments in order to keep track of products. And for the U.S. government to have chosen that standard, it's called the EPC2 standard, for the U.S. government to have chosen insecure product tracking tags to put into people's secure driver's licenses, there's only one possible reason they would have chosen that particular form of RFID. It's because they want people to be tracked by all of those environments along with the products. So that means every time you walk into a Walmart store, if you have an RFID driver's license in your wallet and you haven't shielded it, which most people don't, then the U.S. government will be able to simply subpoena the records from Walmart, or heck, why subpoena them? Just ask for them, and they would, or build a back door into them so you can access them anytime. And they would be able to tell where all of the people of the planet are, or at least of the country are, pretty much at all times. Every gas station, you know, every courthouse, every place that is a public space. You can even put these things in the woods. So there are RFID readers that are powered by vibrations from the trees in the wind that don't even have a power source that you could put in the woods to literally detect when people walk by. So that's probably my biggest concern with RFID right now, is that it has been embedded into all of the enhanced driver's licenses. And it's also been quietly embedded into all of the credit cards. And what this means is that the very same RFID chip that can be in your Visa or your MasterCard or your Discover card or your American Express Wave and Pay card, that technology quietly has been incorporated into virtually all of the credit cards being issued in America today. At least every major brand has a Wave and Go or contactless version of their credit card. And the other thing that's quietly happened over the last 10 years is all of the cash registers in America and across the globe even have been equipped with reader devices that can pick up the signal from contactless credit cards with RFID chips in them. So this means that when you're in a taxi in New York and you see the little device on the back seat that you can put your credit card into, you no longer have to insert the credit card and read the mag stripe. You can simply hold the credit card near, within a couple of inches of the reader device, because it has an RFID reader in it, and it automatically reads that chip in the credit card. And when you take that to the next step, given that now virtually every retail store, grocery store, clothing store, taxi, gas station, even vending machines are now being outfitted with the ability to read contactless RFID cards, then if you take the microchip that's in the card, that's in the credit card, and you extract it from the credit card and you put it into a capsule of glass, you can actually inject that into the flesh of a human being. And there are hobbyists who all over the world have injected these microchips inside of capsules of glass literally into their hands. And those people are able to simply wave their hand in front of a cash register or a taxi cab reader or a vending machine and have the unique ID number, instead of being in a credit card, literally be in their hand. And they're actually buying and selling, well, they're not selling, but they're buying with a number swiped through their right hand. And what's particularly interesting about that is that this exact scenario was predicted 2,000 years ago in the Bible. It's actually the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. The Apostle John, who was one of the 12 apostles of Jesus Christ, had, as a very old man long after Christ had been crucified, he was traveling around that region and telling people about Jesus and about Christianity. He was arrested, and he was actually sent off to work in the mines, sent off in exile to an island called Patmos, which is off the coast of Greece. And it was there as an old man, some people say he was in his 80s when this happened, that he had a vision. And Jesus Christ himself appeared to him and said, I'm going to tell you basically how this whole show is going to end. And I want you to watch what I'm going to show you. And then I want you to write it all down. And then it's going to go, you know, it's going to go on to your descendants and people of the future will know what to expect. And one of the things he wrote in that book, which has now become the Christian, the last book in the Christian Bible, the book of Revelation, is the story of John's vision. It talks about a time when all people on the globe, and it actually specifies everybody, and it says great and small, rich and poor, free and imprisoned or enslaved, so basically everybody, will be forced to receive a mark on their right hand or their forehead, and presumably that's if you don't have a right hand, if it's been cut off, you could put it on your forehead, in order to buy and sell, and they will be buying and selling with this mark, which is actually a number. So the concept that you could use a number which is in your right hand or your forehead to buy or sell was inconceivable to John 2,000 years ago. He had a really hard time understanding how that could happen. And he was told, don't worry, these words are faithful and true. Write them down. And when the time comes, people will know exactly what it's all about. But you're not going to understand this, so don't worry, just write it down. So he wrote it down, and 2,000 years later, this book has been preserved. I mean, you think about how many things were written on parchment 2,000 years ago that are still with us today, and the answer is almost none. But this is actually the number one most published book on earth is the Holy Bible, and it's right there in the last book, and it was preserved. And now we are the first generation for 2,000 years who is actually living in a time when it is possible to make a payment with your right hand using a number. Something that was, when I was a little girl in the 1970s, I couldn't even imagine how it would be possible, and yet here it is. And so the Bible refers to this number in the right hand as, quote, the mark of the beast. People have probably heard of that from rock music. It's the 666, or the mark of the beast, or the number of the beast,
Iron Maiden,
or the number of his name. Yeah. And basically, people are already today putting numbers in their hands. There was just a couple of months ago, a guy in Sweden who was in Finland, somewhere in Scandinavia, who held a press conference, a businessman, saying that he was the first person on the globe to receive one of these microchips with his credit card information encoded inside of it. I'm sorry, it wasn't credit card, it was his Bitcoin information encoded inside of it. And thus, he no longer needs to carry a wallet. He can simply wave his right hand and make payments using Bitcoins. So we are heading into this time, and I believe that all of this, the enhanced driver's licenses, the injectable form of RFID, the chips in the credit cards, you know, if you think about it, what is it that you need to actually present to the world? Well, you've got to present your identity to prove that you're really you. If you get pulled over, you want to get on a plane, and you've got to be able to make purchases in order to live in today's world. And so it's possible to take those two things, which are both security documents, and make them an actual part of your body so that someone else couldn't come along with a gun and steal it. They can't take the chip out of your hand. And it would make it possible for people to no longer have to have keys or wallets or really any of that. There's only one problem, and that is that the Bible warned that anyone who participated in this system will be permanently punished and cut off from God. So Christians are absolutely forbidden from participating in this system. And for many years, when I was even a child, I couldn't even imagine how you would buy and sell with a number, because in the 1970s, when I was a little girl, there were literally not even any credit cards. So when my parents bought things, they bought them with cash or they wrote a check on rare occasion. But I had never seen a credit card. I'd never seen a barcode, because they weren't in wide use until the middle of the 1980s. Actually, 1984 was when Walmart mandated that all of its suppliers had to start using barcodes. And before that, there really weren't any barcodes. Even though they didn't be invented in the 1970s, they didn't appear on any products until 1984. And so this notion when I was a child of, well, how do you buy and sell with a number? I couldn't imagine. How do you put the number on the right hand or in the right hand or the forehead? I couldn't imagine. And then how could you have a global system where somebody on Mount Kilimanjaro or in downtown New York or Tokyo, somebody in Buenos Aires would be able, to make a payment and have some global government, because that's the other thing the Bible talks about, is that there will be a global government and an evil global leader of this global government who will require people to do this. And I thought, how in the world would you know if you're, you know, deep in the Amazon jungle or you're up on Mount Kilimanjaro, how would they be able to know if you were buying and selling with this mark or if you were just, I don't know, paying cash or bartering or doing something else?
Well, now we have
those. What's interesting is we got the internet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have the ability to actually monitor all of these.
And Facebook and Google are flying the internet balloons in all of these places you just mentioned that are far off. So, as you say, people will be able to connect online in Kilimanjaro thanks to Google's, you know, drones and balloons that are flying, providing the internet, correct?
And that's exactly what I believe is being built, is precisely that, the ability. Mark Zuckerberg, I don't know if you saw the recent Time magazine article earlier this year, but Mark Zuckerberg was featured on the cover, and it shows him in a village in India surrounded by children wearing rags. And the children look like their life is rather tough. They're in a town where the roads are not paved. There are goats in the streets. It's all dirt. And these children are struggling to even receive an education or adequate food. And here's Mark Zuckerberg, you know, wearing his Western clothes and his big smile. And he's talking about how he was meeting with Indian authorities to talk about how to bring the internet to everyone in India. And the only thing I could think is, why would these children need the internet? The last thing they need to do is become addicted to Facebook and World of Warcraft and, you know, Grand Theft Auto and who knows what all else. Why do they even need computers when they're struggling to even receive a basic education, learn how to read or write? But you're right that this is the push. And I believe that it is not just a, you know, an economic issue, a technological issue, but it's a deeply spiritual issue, because the components of all of this that would be required to come together in order to enable a global ruler to have absolute and total control over every single being on the planet. I mean, that's pretty incredible if you think about it. The omniscience and omnipresence and omnipotence and all those omni words are the province of God. That, you know, it's God who knows every time a sparrow falls from the sky. It's God who numbers the hairs on a human head. God knows all of these things. And what we have been building, what humanity has been building, is the capability to really have godlike powers, to monitor individuals, to know what happens in their homes, to know what words they speak, what they look like, what conversations they have, what their homes look like, every detail about them, every purchase they make. And all of this has been built literally within the last 15 or 20 years, and really in earnest within, I'd say, the last probably 6 or 7 years since the cell phones became ubiquitous and the iPhone came out. Hard to believe that that was only 2009. It really feels like it's been with us forever, but it's only been, you know, 6 years.
So
it hasn't been that long, and yet the whole world is addicted. The whole world is staring at these things, and the whole world has voluntarily chosen now to put a tracking device that links them into the global brain, so that the Google network, the Apple network, the Facebook network, which eventually will all merge, are able to monitor people's behavior. And if you look at the other things these companies are doing, they're not just creating internet products and phone products, but they're actually creating surveillance capability and enforcement capability. And if you think about Google, one of their big products that they've been advertising heavily is Google Nest. And it's this notion that you would voluntarily place a camera and an audio recording device in the deepest, most private part of your life, in your home, in your bedroom, in your living room, in your dining room, around your dining table, to literally record yourself and provide the footage to servers which are owned by Google. So that you're basically allowing the tentacles of this global brain to go into the very depth of your privacy. And it's amazing to me how willing people are to adopt these technologies that, you know, if you think about George Orwell's book 1984, which came out in 1948, before any of this technology existed, George Orwell envisioned a totalitarian nightmare world in which a Big Brother government would force people to participate in the surveillance at gunpoint. I think he never anticipated the way it's really unfolded today, where it's sort of the new form of tyranny. You know, 20th century tyranny, if you were Stalin or Hitler, or Pol Pot in Cambodia, it used guns and tanks. Certainly they had surveillance and informants, the KGB, East Germany and the Soviet bloc, all of those folks were very into surveillance, but the surveillance was imposed at gunpoint. You had informants infiltrating. No one trusted anyone. You had this ominous feeling of Big Brother always having the capability of just killing you, and you had to comply, but you couldn't wait to get free of the darkness of that. Well, that's 20th century tyranny. 21st century tyranny has arrived grinning with a fistful of coupons. It's got a very different feel to it. And what 21st century tyranny has become is they've figured out, and I believe that the ability to look at people's posts on Facebook and watch and monitor, keep your finger on the pulse of public response, is a hugely powerful capability of those who would try to control public opinion. Because, see, my degree, I have a doctorate from Harvard in human development and psychology, and I also have an undergraduate degree in marketing. And one of the things that we worry about as human, researchers of human psychology is, how do you figure out what people really think? And in the past, prior to the internet, you had to pay focus groups. You would pay people $50 to sit around for an hour in a group of 10 or 20 and tell you their opinion about a new product, or tell you their opinion about a political leader, or tell you their opinion about a particular topic. And then you had to extrapolate from these 10 or 20 people and look at their demographics and who was young and old and male and female and black and white. And you had to decide, well, how does the general public feel? And it was a hard thing to do. What's happened now is that you have instant access to millions of people's responses in real time to whatever it is that you want to monitor. And so you can modify messages on the fly instantaneously. And it gives you an incredible amount of power to manipulate the viewpoints of the public, mm-hmm. and to manipulate people's responses to things. Because if you put something out there and people respond negatively, then you just modify it. And then you look at the response, modify it, look at the response until you get the positive response you want. So there's a new incredible power that no one's really acknowledged, and it's the ability to do instantaneous research on public response in real time in a way that's never been possible before.
And so
we've now got that capability. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I just touching on my next question, because I want to ask you afterwards about Start Mail and what people can do to protect themselves. But you mentioned how people today, they don't seem to care. And in Spy Chips, you cite Kevin Ashton and Adolf Hitler, and they basically say, for this surveillance society to work, the older generation will have to die, and the new generation will accept the surveillance state without question. So, I mean, what would you say to people who say, you know, that we're paranoid for worrying about these threats? And then you mentioned democide in your book, where I think a lot of people don't understand the nature of evil, and they forget the long view of history, as you've mentioned, these totalitarian regimes in the past, which, you know, can always come back again, and they are coming back again in other parts of the world. So
I think there are people in Iraq right now who certainly view the U.S. as a deadly totalitarian regime. I think there are people across Afghanistan and across the Middle East who probably believe that totalitarian deadly regimes are not far off in the future. They're actually living under them because they've been imposed on them by the U.S. government. So I think it just depends on where you live as to how heavily you feel the crushing boot of Big Brother right now. But I think there's going to come a time when we're all going to feel it crushing us equally. I want to address this topic of democide that you brought up, because I really appreciate your bringing that up, because that informs all of the research that I do. And democide is a term coined by R.J. Rummel, who's a political scientist at the University of Hawaii, who devoted his entire career to studying basically this notion that government's primary impact of government upon people, and this is going to be a shocking statement, is to kill them. And when he studied all of the political scientists, they said, oh, no, well, politics are about building roads and about elections and about, you know, furthering access to clean water and all these other things. Sure, they are. But what people lose sight of is the fact that governments, because they have unequaled access to weaponry and to enforcement capability, you have to understand that governments are nothing more, you know, government is not instituted by, you know, I don't know, God himself comes down and decides to rule the world in a benevolent way. Government is ruled by people, and they're people who have sought power over other people and managed to obtain it. That's really what a government official is someone who wanted power and got it. And unfortunately, because of our fallen state and how humans are, when people get power over other people, they really do tend to run in a very bad direction and utilize that power to further their own interests. And if people oppose them, then oftentimes they wind up jailing those people, passing laws against them, and ultimately killing them or committing genocide. And so what R.J. Rummel discovered is that the deadliest force on planet Earth, and he looked at the 20th century, by a factor of almost 10 were people's own governments. And I'm going to put it conservatively at 6 times more people were killed in the 20th century by their own governments than were killed by all of the century's wars combined. So government is not only more deadly than warfare, it is actually 6 to 10 times more deadly than warfare. So the only other thing that kills more people are natural causes and disease. Other than that, no terrorist is going to manage to murder 60 million people like Stalin did during his murderous regime in the Soviet Union, or 20 million people, you know, 15 to 20 million people as Hitler did during his brief reign. I mean, there's really a shocking statistic when you look at it. And so I think people need to be aware that the reason the U.S. government has been effective for 200 years plus is because it was based on a constitution that said we founding fathers recognize that government tends to take people's liberties away and stomp on them. And so a series of checks and balances were put in place to restrict government, to control government, to sort of hold the monster at bay and keep it in chains so that it could not restrict the liberties of the American people. And we've seen increasingly those constitutional protections being stripped away. They're called archaic. We don't need them anymore. Who needs that old 200-year-old stuff? We're going to find a new way to do things. And we've got to really resist that because it was wisdom that put those restrictions in place. Unfortunately, now the government is getting involved in the biggest form of power of all, which is surveillance power. We know this because Ed Snowden told us about the, you know, all of the ways that the government is able to monitor and spy on us and watch what we do. And ultimately, that enables them to do what tyrants have wanted to do throughout all of history, which is to identify their opponents, identify who would like to remove them from office, who is objecting or a dissident or you know, who is a person of conscience who doesn't like the direction things are going, who's an activist. You know, I myself have been the subject of a tremendous amount of surveillance in a terrible way. And that's the kind of power that you can have over people to cause them to keep their heads low, become silent, just go along to get along, not agitate or fight for change. Mm-hmm. And so I think all of that is certainly a big, big effect of all this technology.
And what would you tell, you know, the Facebook generation, as well as other Christians who have no problem with the surveillance and they share all their information online? And then if you could tell us after that, what are some ways that people can protect themselves as well as about Start Mail?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, this younger generation has been specifically molded, shaped, manipulated, and fed propaganda to believe the way they do about these things. This is not a mistake. I was talking to a friend of mine who has a daughter in high school in Texas. And in her English class, there's a big poster up on the wall, and it says, "A life not observed is not worth living." I thought, oh my goodness, that's quite a statement. Unless observed by others, it's not worth living. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is one of the reasons why we see oversharing on the internet, why people are taking selfies even in funerals and tragic events. They're taking selfies. They're so focused on other people observing their lives that they're not even living their own lives. But this is all, you know, the Big Brother television program that was out, 10 plus years ago, the notion of putting cameras into the home, the notion that being watched makes you a celebrity, that being watched is not about you being a rat in a cage being observed by Big Brother, but being watched, being on camera makes you like Marilyn Monroe. It makes you famous. It makes you important. You're beautiful, and cameras want to watch you, and people care about you, and they care about what you do. And I think for that reason, because our celebrity culture, which is a recent thing, it's only been around for, you know, since the mid-1800s and only in earnest since movies came out in the 1920s, this celebrity culture that filming and recording and watching and listening and knowing all the private elements of your life makes you important in a celebrity is a really twisted logic, but it's really effective. And so I think by having all these reality TV shows where, look, we can watch you in your own home having conversations with your husband and millions of people care what you're saying to each other, you're having that argument or you're doing whatever, that it causes people to say, well, I want to get a drop cam in my house. So I want to record every one of my conversations and arguments because I'm beautiful and I'm important too. And so this younger generation is being trained to become narcissists. Mm-hmm. They're being trained to be very focused on their own selves and their looks and their beauty and their importance. And it all feeds into this very deeply spiritually concerning move to say that people need to be monitored so they can be controlled. And ultimately, this is because something will be imposed on them and there will be no place to hide. Once you have a drop cam in every home and it's mandated by law that there's a camera in your shower in case you fall down, or a camera in your bedroom in case somebody abuses a child or who knows what. Once it's mandated, and by the way, Google has a patent for the home of the future that I found earlier this year, and they actually talk about this, mandating, passing laws in communities that would mandate that there would be not even one single square foot of your home that was not under video surveillance. And they don't promote this to say Big Brother needs to watch you so there's no place to hide. They promote it so they say, well, if there's ever an intruder in your house, we need to make sure that law enforcement, government officials, university researchers, and marketers will be able to monitor what's going on in your home to keep you safe and won't it be convenient. And they even talk about having sensors built into the alarm clock so that it would monitor your breathing pattern. It would know what time you went to bed and what time you got up in the morning. So maybe if you didn't get enough sleep, your car would actually monitor your driving the next day. And all of this is not even for your benefit. They actually have a little diagram in the patent that Google filed that shows how this information goes to all these third parties and how useful it's going to be for them to know everything. They even talk about parents, if you're missing your teenager, well, that's all right. We'll just flip on the locator because we'll know if your child is in someone else's home because everyone else's home will be monitored too. And we'll know every visitor who comes in the front door because they'll have to sort of take their little wristband and or their chip implant or whatever and put it up to the reader and say, I'm now entering the Jones's house. You know, or when you sit down to eat a meal, they'll monitor what the meal is, so they'll make sure that you're eating healthy. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of surveillance. And in 1984, I think if George Orwell could come back from the grave and look at what's happening today, he would not believe that his worst nightmare of intensive monitoring of people's personal lives has followed this new 21st century tyranny model, which is where people not only don't oppose it, but they welcome it and they themselves create it and participate in it. They themselves, see, if you were Stalin and you wanted to monitor all your opponents, how in the world, let's say you had cameras, mm-hmm. what would it cost you to buy all those cameras and then get jackbooted soldiers with guns to go to every house marching around and forcing people, you know, screaming with their babies, crying, cowering in the corner to put these cameras in their homes? I mean, that would really be expensive and very hard, and people would hate you. What a better model to simply use all the new insights of social psychology and the manipulation capability of television to convince people that it's a cool thing to put those very same cameras in their own homes. So not only that way, you not only get them to willingly comply, you get a population that doesn't resist or oppose your imposition upon them, and you get a population on top of that that is willing to pay you hundreds of dollars for the privilege of being monitored, and so you get rich at the same time. So unlike Stalin, who would probably go bankrupt trying to do this, these companies, Google and Facebook and you know, all these surveillance companies are making billions of dollars. In fact, they're the wealthiest companies on the face of the globe right now. And this is just sheer genius. Google has 21andMe, which is the the DNA service. And we actually got, my husband and I got one of these in the mail. We're like, you got to be kidding me. They said, now we'll reduce it from $200 to just $99. You can spit into this little vial and send it back and we'll analyze all your DNA for you. Won't that be great? And I'm thinking to myself, like, I'm going to pay $99 to give you all of my. That's the kind of thing that you'd have to send a tank to my house and have 50 soldiers with, you know, major guns making me lie down on the floor to swab my mouth to get my DNA. And yet you're getting people to voluntarily give it to you and pay you $100. Nice work. Nice work if you can get it. And that's what's happening. So if you mandated 15, 20, 30 years ago that every single person in America had to carry a continual tracking device that located them to within 5 feet at all times, day or night, you would have had a revolution. This is a well-armed country. This country would have literally risen up in rebellion against such a mandate. But if you call it an iPhone and you make all kinds of addicting games and selfie sticks and make it a really fun way to document everything about yourself, then people not only don't oppose you, they welcome it and they pay $600 for the privilege of having this garbage. Mm-hmm. So what's happening to young people? They've been brainwashed. They've been absolutely addicted to some of the most addictive stuff ever invented in the history of humanity. Do you know that addiction studies, which happened in the 20th century to discover why people developed unhealthy addictions to gambling and sexual activity and drugs, that all of those studies were turned around and used to build addiction properties into the technology, to build Blizzard used it to build addictive qualities into World of Warcraft, which is why that game has destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives, including of my own friends who've lost homes and families and jobs and health due to the addictive nature of these things. So the next time you're at a restaurant, you see a birthday party and half the people at the table are not even participating because they're staring into their phones. That's because that interesting, intriguing, I must look at my phone quality was intentionally built in there to addict people so that they would adopt these technologies and so that they themselves would place the chains and the fetters on their own ankles and the handcuffs on their own wrists so that they would become the property of the thing that's coming.
And what are some tips you would give? For example, I started using StartMail as a beta user, and I really liked it. You know, I had faith in it, and I think one of the things when it comes in terms of protecting yourself and choosing the ways you want to protect yourself and choosing companies is trust. And I felt I can trust StartMail because you were part of the team, and you know, you're a Christian and you're a public figure and you're an expert on the topic. And so I trusted StartMail, and I've renewed my subscription as well as for my wife. We both use it. And, you know, what are some things that people can do to protect themselves from this type of totalitarian, you know, surveillance so they can get a private email like StartMail? And what are a few other things?
Well, I'm so glad you're bringing up StartMail. So I've been an activist since 1999 working on these topics. And I remember doing an interview, this is probably 2005, 2006-ish, around the spy trips years. And somebody called in and said, on this radio show, and said, Catherine, you know what you really need is a suicide hotline. And I'm like, what? And she says, yeah, because you're scaring us all to death. And so we finish this interview and we go back to our lives and we're scared out of our minds and we have no solutions. And I got to thinking about it and I thought, you know, that's true, because for the last, what, 5, 7 years at that time, I said, all I've been doing is warning people and sounding an alarm, but I haven't really been providing alternatives. And so in 2009, I actually realized for the first time what Google was. I used to love Google, like everybody else, colorful, happy name, friendly company, really helpful. And I loved them. And then I realized that the purpose of Google was not to answer my every question, because how's that going to make them money? That the purpose of Google was to provide a window on every computer on planet Earth and every cell phone on planet Earth, in order to capture what's going on in people's minds at any given moment. So if you think about this, let me go back to Stalin again, of the Soviet Union. He had to employ a whole army of informants. So if you had a birthday party, they would send informants over to your party who would listen to see if you said anything, oh, I don't know, against the government or said anything revolutionary, you know, anti-revolution, counter-revolution, whatever. They knew who their enemies were because they had informants watching, but they couldn't watch everything. So what Google has done, and it's sheer genius that the U.S. public and the world public hasn't caught on to this and probably never will, is Google has figured out the way to find out what everybody's doing all the time. And I'll give you an example. If you use Google as your search engine, they know who cuts your hair. Because, and by the way, do you know who's some guy, and let's pick some person in Brazil, do you know who cuts their hair? Of course not. You have no idea. It could be their wife. It could be the barber down the street. It could be an expensive salon. You don't have any idea. And I'll just use this as an example, that Google knows everything about you. In fact, I don't know who cuts my mom's hair, but Google knows. Well, my mom doesn't use Google. She uses the alternative I helped to create, which is called Start Page. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But let's say just the issue of hair cutting, Google can tell you who cuts the hair of every single person in this country, even though I don't even know who cuts my best friend's hair. How does Google know this? Because who uses the Yellow Pages anymore? Who uses a phone book? But there are probably young people listening going, what's a phone book? What are the Yellow Pages? What are you talking about? Because if you want to look up the name of or the phone number for your local hair cutting place, most people go into Google and they type local hair cutting place called, you know, the Superstar Hair, and then they get the phone number and then they call up and they make an appointment. And a lot of people, when they make that appointment, they put it on their Google calendar. So now you know it's Wednesday at 3 p.m. You're going to go get a haircut. And the same is true for everything else. I just use that as one example. But they know what most people had for dinner last night because they themselves or their wives or whoever looked up the recipe for lamb chops on Google. They know that you're worried about losing your job because you looked up unemployment insurance on Google. They know if you're having marriage problems because you looked up a marital counselor on Google. They know if your kids are using drugs or if you think you're addicted because you're looking up addiction. They know if you have a rash between your toes because you look it up on Google. And so what's happened is that Google has morphed from being kind of an interesting college experiment years ago to figure out how to organize all the information on the internet to suddenly becoming this gaping honeypot, this vast information suck that wants to know what's going on in individuals' lives. And it captures the information in individuals' lives 10, 20, 30 times a day. And I'll go back to Stalin. What if Stalin had mandated that every person in the Soviet Union had to say what was on their mind, what they were doing, and who they were doing it with 10 times a day? Everybody, again, would have said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't know if they could have risen up and rebelled. He probably would have killed them all. But people would have thought, well, that's totalitarian and horrible. But when Google does it, people say, oh, how friendly and helpful that they answer all my questions. But you need to realize that the only reason they care about answering your questions is not because they derive any benefit at all from you knowing stuff, but because they derive massive amounts of benefit from knowing everything about you. And so when I discovered this in 2009, I swear I wanted to go live in the woods and get rid of my computer. Because I said, I can't use the internet at all without Google, first of all, because how are you going to find anything? And I can't let them be monitoring me because none of this is any of their business. And so I searched the globe and I found a tiny little company in the Netherlands called, at that time, IxQuick, I-X-Q-U-I-C-K. And I do a daily radio show, kmashow.com, and I invited IxQuick on my show. And I interviewed him and he told me that they had created this tiny search engine that was capable of searching the entire internet just like Google. It was a meta search engine, so they used all sorts of other search engines like Dogpile and, you know, stuff you've never heard of. And they had a software that would take your search, submit it to all these places instantaneously, get the best results, give them to you privately, and then delete all records of your visit so that nobody was watching what you were searching for. And it was funded by advertisements, but rather than being advertisements based on knowing everything about you like Google does, they were advertising simply based on your search. Like if you looked up diamond rings, it might give you some online diamond ring stores, for example. So I said, well, this is really cool. So I started using IxQuick. I fell in love with it. And I got back to the company and I said, I want to work for you because this is a solution that I can start promoting and actually make some traction, make some progress so people don't need a suicide hotline. So the very first thing I did was recommend that the name Ixquick was really hard to use and people wanted Google search results. So I helped them to create the startpage.com search engine, and it's now being used by millions of people as their homepage, their start page, including me. And we created an easier to use name, which is Startpage. And what Startpage does is it takes your search and submits it to Google for you. So we're kind of like a proxy between you and Google. So Ixquick.com is everybody but Google. So if you don't want Google results at all, then you should use Ixquick. But if you want Google search results privately, you should use Startpage. And when you get there, it says powered by Google. But all that means is that we actually get real Google search results. Google doesn't know who did the search. They only know that like 5 million searches a day are coming through Startpage, but they don't know what they're for, who's doing the searching. They just know we searched. And then we get the results. We give them to you privately. We strip out all the tracking cookies that Google would be using. And then we delete all records of your visit. So we have no idea who's searching or what they're searching for on our website. And it's a really easy way to, you can add it to your browser, you can make it in the upper right-hand window there, you can make it your homepage, but it's an easy way to immediately take this huge floodgate, like a fire hydrant of information that you're blasting into Google's brain, and reduce it down to a trickle. And so it's kind of an easy way to sort of dial back on the massive amount of information you're sharing. So if you want to look up who cuts your hair, and you know it's the hair place or whatever, then you can type it in. We submit it to Google. We get the answer. We give it to you, and Google has no idea who to search for the hair place. So if they say, well, Catherine, who cuts your hair? Then Google will say, I have no idea because she never searches with us. Bummer. She's gone dark. Mm-hmm. So that's Startpage.
And Startmail as well. I've switched over to it, my wife, and I'm not using Gmail anymore or Google, and it took me a long time to make that switch, and it's exactly for the reasons that you described, and I really recommend people look into that and check out
Startmail. Well, let me explain Startmail. So we had Startpage for like 5 years, and then I said, well, what's the next big privacy problem that needs to be solved? And the answer is email. So in order to understand email, you need to understand what happened in 2004. So prior to 2004, we had Earthlink and Netcom and AOL, if people remember all those, and there was Yahoo back then. And all those email providers had really good privacy policies that mimicked the U.S. Postal Service's policies of we just deliver the mail, we don't read it. And so if you look back prior to 2004, you'll find that all those companies guaranteed you that they would never read your email. They just delivered it. And that's the way it should be. Then in 2004, Google, which was becoming a search giant at that point, got greedy. And what they said was it's not enough to simply know if people are searching for cancer information or unemployment insurance. We want to know, or unemployment services. We actually want to know what they say to each other when they think nobody's looking. And how in the world are we going to access, how are we going to insert ourselves, how are we going to be able to know what everybody says to one another? And so you got to realize this is a company that wants a drop cam in your home to know what you say to your wife when you're in bed together, all right? That's this company. So their desire for your personal information knows no bounds. It would be illegal for them to figure out a way to hack in everybody's email. So what they did was really brilliant and really diabolical. They said, tell you what, let's find out what the pain point is of people's email, and then we'll solve that problem, whatever it is, and then we'll get them to put their email on our servers and use us, and then we will have access to it all, and we can read it all, and then we'll know what people say to each other. And so thus was Gmail born in 2004. Now, I was part of a coalition back in 2004 of like 25 different privacy organizations, the ACLU and EPIC and EFF and Privacy International and all these different organizations. We all got together and we wrote a letter in horror to Google in 2004 saying, what are you thinking? You cannot release this new thing you're calling Gmail. And by the way, the pain point that they found was people didn't have enough storage on their email. You may remember if you were using email before 2004 that you'd always get these messages saying, your account is full. You can receive no new messages. Please delete some messages. And so you were always having to go in and delete stuff because you couldn't hold much. and or you'd email somebody else and it would say, sorry, this message was not delivered because the person's email box is full. Well, we don't see that anymore today. And that's because Google came along and said, oh, yeah, they've only got, like, you know, 100 megabytes. Well, we'll give them a gigabyte of storage, and we'll give it to them for free. And that will lure everybody over so that they'll switch away from whatever they're using, start using us, and then we can read all their mail. And imagine how much we'll know. We'll know who they write to. We'll know when they write. We'll know what they buy because they'll get receipts through there. We'll know what time the babysitter is supposed to show up on Saturday night because they'll send that in an email. We'll know their address. We'll know if they send their tax return to their accountant, then we'll be able to open up the attachment, which they do, and then we'll know their Social Security number, their accountant's name, their kids' names, their kids' Social Security numbers, their deductions, their annual income. We'll know everything. And so that's what they did. And we wrote a letter saying, don't do it, because if you do this, you will change the way email is conducted in the world. Little did we know that what we should have written in that letter was, if you change this, it will change the way the internet works. Because what happened was Google went ahead and did this Gmail thing. They disregarded our letter, totally didn't care what we said. Everybody switched over to these Gmail accounts, not realizing that the whole reason Google was offering free email with a gigabyte of storage was so that they could put your email in their clutches and read it all. And then everybody switched over, and it made them a flipping fortune. And because it made them so rich, the entire internet has now followed suit. And the whole internet and all of the apps and everything else related to all this technology is based almost entirely on capturing your personal information. When you take an app now and you put it on your phone, if you look at the fine print, the app, which may be something helpful that you really want, will say in the fine print, and by the way, we're going to access all of your GPS location and all of your contacts so we know who all your friends are and we can contact them too. It's really creepy. And it's all because Google created Gmail back in 2004 so that they could read all of your email. So they now know every single thing you search for with Google. So you should use Start Page instead of Google. And they now know everything you write to everybody else. And so you should use Start Mail instead of Gmail. So in 3 years ago, I brought to our executive team, which is Dutch, by the way. They're like I said, this tiny company in the Netherlands. Wonderful, wonderful people, care deeply about privacy. I love them. Just they're fantastic. And we're in this meeting. And I said, you know, guys, what we really need to do is offer email. And so, long story short, they spent 3 years building it, and it is the most secure email that has ever been built in the history of technology. It is absolutely airtight. It has 3 layers of encryption, which even the NSA can't break, according to Ed Snowden. And you have the security with a StartMail account of knowing that no one can read your email. We don't read it. We never read anybody's messages. Gmail is based on, it's built on reading your messages. So it's absolutely guaranteed that they will read every message they receive. It's absolutely guaranteed that we will read nothing. Your email is dark. It's encrypted. We can't even get into it because it's in a user vault. And what's more, we even have the capability within StartMail that you can write to somebody else at their Gmail account, and you can actually have a correspondence with a Gmail account holder that Google can't see. And we do that through something called question and answer encryption, which resides on our servers in the Netherlands. So we basically, let's say you want to write to your friend Marie and she's got a Gmail account, we will create a little space on a StartMail server in the Netherlands outside of U.S. jurisdiction, outside of Google's clutches, where you and Marie can write back and forth 5, 10, 50, 100 emails. It doesn't matter. And we'll create a little space. We basically create a miniature email account for the two of you that doesn't cost you any money. It's just part of your StartMail service. And that way, even though Marie is using Gmail, Google can't see what you guys are writing because we give you a space to have that correspondence on our servers. So the service is called StartMail because our regular service is called StartPage, and it just made sense. And the catch here is that our team said, well, Catherine, it's going to cost us $1 million to build this thing. And I said, yeah, but it, you know, kind of like Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. And I guaranteed to my team that if we built StartMail, that people would actually be willing to pay money for the service, because we don't have, you know, Google makes money because they spy on you and then they run advertisements based on the secrets they know about you, and that's very profitable for them. Well, if you don't spy on people, then you basically, they become your customers. See, Google's customers are the advertisers, and their email is just the bait to get you to deposit personal information that they can use for their advertisers' benefit. So the real customer is the advertiser. You're not a customer, and that's not a product. That's actually bait, and you know you're the product that they're luring in to sell. But with StartPage, you're actually our customer. We answer to our customers, and that means that somebody's got to pay us so that we can actually keep the lights on and stay in business and offer these great security products. Mm-hmm. So StartMail is $5 a month. That's $60 a year. You get, for that, three accounts. So you get your account and then two companion accounts that you could give like you did to your wife or, mm-hmm. or your best friend or your business partner or your attorney. And so it's three accounts for $5 a month. It works out to about $1.67 a month per account. And given that U.S. stamps now, first-class stamps are 50 cents a piece, that's like three stamps a month, basically, in terms of the cost. And we just celebrated yesterday. We sent out a press release that we just hit our 10,000 subscriber mark. We're really excited at 10,000 people. We've got a growing community of people who are using StartMail. We had 70,000 beta testers. So we've had almost 100,000 people enjoy using StartMail, and we're really hoping that people care enough about their privacy. I mean, for $1.67, you can't even get a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that people consider private email and getting back to full privacy important enough that they're willing to pay for it. And we encourage people to try out a 7-day free trial. You can kick the tires. You can see all the features of it by going to startmail.com. There's a little video that I recorded that explains how it works with an overview and why you need it. And it's startmail.com, and it's really fantastic. I stand behind it. I help to create it. And you're right. I've been doing this for 15 years, and it's really my life.
And we've run a little over time, but my last question, which I ask to all of my guests real quick, is, you know, what words of wisdom would you have for the next generation of high school, university students, young folks who are entering unwittingly into a world running headlong into dystopia, as you've described it? You've given us a great in-depth overview of the totalitarian nature of surveillance, as I'd like to say.
Well, I think it's a question of what's coming. You have to, you need to pray for discernment and ask God to help you see what's really going on, the tentacles of the thing that's building itself. That right now is the happy time. You know, right now is the fun time. Right now is the, look at all these goodies I'm going to give you time, until you surround yourself with it and you clamp those fetters onto your ankles and the handcuffs onto your wrists, and then the ugly time is going to come. And it is coming. There's no question about it. R.J. Rummel says power corrupts and absolute power. Well, it was Lord Acton said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. R.J. Rummel, the political scientist, converted that to power kills and absolute power kills absolutely. We are building the most powerful power over human beings that has ever existed in all of human history. There is no chance that kind of power over people will not be abused. It is going to happen, and when it happens, it will be very ugly. And so my number one piece of advice to people is that God is real, that the message of the Bible is absolutely true, that there are more, you know, this is a statistic I want to share. People believe, because the mainstream media is trying to brainwash them into believing, that Christianity is this little tiny faith that's dying out. I would like people to know that Christianity, if you were to stand on the moon with a telescope and go, what's this earth place and what do they believe? That the answer would be, it's a Christian place. There are 2.6 billion Christians on this earth. There are far more Christians than any other faith, including atheism. So 2.6 billion Christians, seconded by 1.8 billion Muslims who also worship the God of Abraham, followed by around 2 million secular humanist atheists. So there are over twice as many Christians on planet Earth as there are atheists. I just want people to be aware of that. This is not a fading out religion. This is a religion that came 2,000 years ago, populated the Earth, has taken over the Earth because it explains what's happening right now. And so my number one piece of advice for high school and college students, and take this from somebody with a Harvard doctorate, is pick up your Bible, dust it off. You can start with the book of Matthew. It's the first book in the New Testament. It will tell you everything you need to know about Christ. And then once you understand that, I have a new book out which is called I Won't Take the Mark, and it's actually about the mark of the beast. It actually explains the story of Revelation. You can find it online at virtuepress.com. It's also available on Amazon. And what it is it's a picture book, but it's for children and adults, because I've actually taken excerpts from the King James Bible on every page, along with a beautiful illustration. And it explains what's happening with this mark that's coming, the buying and selling with a number, the global takeover, which is spiritual in nature, which was predicted 2,000 years ago. It is absolutely real. It is absolutely true. If you pray about it and you ask God to show this to you and give you discernment, you will begin to understand all the things that seem crazy that are going on in the world, and they'll start making perfect sense. And if you get afraid, you don't need to be afraid, because just like the sinking of the Titanic, there were lifeboats that people could get into, and the people who got in the lifeboats were saved. And there is a lifeboat for this sinking ship called Planet Earth, and that lifeboat is the saving blood of Jesus Christ himself. That lifeboat is available to anyone who wants to climb into it, and if you read the book of Matthew, it will actually show you how. So that's my parting advice. This is scary stuff. You don't need a suicide hotline. You just need God.
Well, thank you, Dr. Albrecht, for your time. Great words of wisdom. I highly recommend people check out startpage.com, StartMail, as well as your website and your radio show, which broadcasts daily, I believe.
And that's kmashow.com. I just want to remind people, kmashow.com, or just my name, katherinealbrecht.com. And it streams right on the website, so if you don't have access to a local radio station, you can listen there. There are also several thousand hours of archives that you can access from that website as well. So feel free. It's all free, downloadable, tons of content on kmashow.com. Check it out.